Decision will come to order. We do have a quorum present, so we're going to get started. It's kind of a strange day because the session was scheduled, as you all know, to start at 12:15. We've asked leadership just to notify us when the session starts because we really don't know when it will be, and then we could recess to go up there. But in the meantime, we have a full agenda, and we'd like to get started. We have a number of people who have made arrangements to come and speak to us today, and we want to take advantage of their presence and start working. I would like to start by just welcoming everyone and all the members of the committee. I'm very honored to serve as the chair of this committee. And I wanted to introduce everyone so we can get to know each other, and then we'll start with our testimony. Maybe I'll start with the staff, and then we can do the senators. Most of you probably know my staff, Don Jarofsky, my committee administrator for the last several years. I have a new legislative assistant, Erica Schumacher. I don't know where our other staff is, but you will see the familiar faces of Carol Baker, our Senate counsel, Greg Knopf, our Senate research, and Dan Mueller, our fiscal analyst. Maybe they think we're not meeting, did they? Okay. Maybe someone should give them a ring. Yeah. Thank you. And Brittany, before you do that, why don't you wave so everyone knows who you are? Brittany Edwards is our committee clerk or committee page, so she'll be staffing our committee this session. We also have from my office an intern, Garrett Peterson, who's a student who's going to be here on committee days and helping run the committee as well. So they're here all to help you. We have other staff. Gloria Gunville is here from Senate Majority Research. Does everyone have this list?
It's in your folder.
Okay, there's some other staff that work for this committee or work with this committee, but they're all listed on the list in your folder. And since we're getting off to kind of a weird start, and so we're missing some people, so I'll just let them introduce themselves later. Why don't we introduce the senators? Senator Tom Saxhog is the vice chair of the committee, and we also have a committee subdivision, which is the energy subdivision, which Senator Kubley will be chairing. And those assignments have gone out, correct, in terms of members that have been appointed to the subdivision. And you should have all received that. If you have any questions about that, please ask my staff, and they can tell you. Maybe we should put that list in the folders next time. We'll get that for everyone. I think everyone here knows each other, except we have two new members, newly elected members in our committee. And so maybe we should just go around briefly and introduce ourselves for the benefit of those who are new and everyone else in the room. And I'm from St. Paul, and I've served in the Senate for 14 years. And I'll go to you next, Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Tom Saxhog, represent District 3, which starts at the northwest angle and ends at Mille Lacs Lake. And I look forward to vice chairing this committee along with the chairman, Senator Anderson.
And I'm Senator Vickerman, representing southwestern Minnesota, the corner of the state. Looking forward to working in this committee. I chair ag, and a lot of this is going to have to do with ag. But I love to hunt, and I love to fish. So that's what I wanted to be on.
Steve Dill, state senator from Dassel, Litchfield, Hutchinson area. This is my 21st year in the legislature. And most of those years I've been on either the Environment Committee, the Ag Committee, or both.
Satvir Chaudhry, Northern Suburbs, Fridley, Columbia Heights, Arden Hills, New Brighton. Also serve as chair of the Environment Policy Committee.
Sandy Rummel, Senate District 53, also Northern Ramsey County and a little piece of Anoka County, and very pleased to be on the committee.
David Hahn, representing District 42, which is Eden Prairie and part of Minnetonka.
Gary Kubley, I represent Senate District 20, starts with Renville County on the east side, goes up through Chippewa and Swift and Big Stone, Yellow Medicine, Lac Parle, and Lincoln on the western edge of the state, and I don't have a little piece of any county.
Pat Pearson, my district number is 36, and it's basically the southern portion of Dakota County. And portion of Goodhue County down to the metropolis of Denison. And I've been here, this is my 19th year, on environment the entire time.
Apparently, there was some confusion out in the Capitol about whether we were meeting on schedule or not. So I'll just apologize on behalf of some of the folks who didn't get the message. And Greg Knopf is here from Senate Research. How long have you served in this capacity, Greg?
What's happening? So I just came down here.
23 and a half years, Madam Chair. At Senate Council and Research, I'm a legislative analyst, however you want
okay.
to do that.
Great. And here, and this is Dan Mueller walking in. And most of you all know are these staff who have lots and lots of expertise and we rely on for just about everything we do in these committees. So Dan Mueller. And I'm sure most people know that the committees obviously have been changed since Senator Sams was the chair last year. And we broke off the ag funding piece and the economic development funding piece, so it's environment and natural resources. But the new part as well that has never been done before is to include energy. And so the energy accounts from the Commerce Department are also in our committee jurisdiction. And I think, as Jim said, there's a lot of convergence going on in the areas of ag, energy, environment, and natural resources. And so we will all be working very closely together, but those are going to be some of the very interesting issues that we'll be dealing with this year. So with that, I will get started. We're going to start today by having a presentation on the Clean Water Legacy, which most of us have heard a lot about, and we want to get an update about where we are at since last year's kickoff of the Clean Water Legacy funding. And we've asked the people to report to us about how things are going and what they see as the need that is facing our state at this point in time for protecting our waters. So with that, let's start with the agency representatives. We've got the first, maybe the three of you. Do you want to come up as a group, the first three? From the PCA, Bowser, and Bowser being the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and the DNR. And members, just for your benefit, I guess I should say a couple more things quickly. I'm trying to set up meetings with all the committee members to talk over your priorities, and I'm making a point of doing that as soon as possible. It's just a matter of scheduling. We haven't gotten to it yet. And next week we'll probably do some general department overviews and start really looking at the agency budget so that we can get to know these agencies better. So if you have questions about the big picture, don't worry. We'll spend lots of time on that, on the big picture. All right. With that, who's going to start? Mr. Reeves?
Yes. Madam Chairman.
Welcome.
Members of the committee, thank you, and good afternoon. My name is Galen Reitz. I work for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Also here with me at the table are Doug Thomas from the Board of Water and Soil Resources and Lee Fanmuller from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. What we're going to do for you this afternoon is give you kind of a brief overview of the Clean Water, Clean Water Legacy. A little bit of background on the federal Clean Water Act requirements that led us in this direction. Minnesota's approach, the cooperation and collaboration going in, and then an update on the status of implementation of the efforts thus far. The federal Clean Water Act, to make sure I hit the right button, Clean Water Act, which was established in 1972, provides states with really an overarching framework for protecting and improving water quality of surface waters in the state. Section 303 of the Clean Water Act specifically requires and establishes national standards for water quality and also establishes the requirements for the total maximum daily loads portion of the Clean Water Act. Section 303D of the Clean Water Act, which is the total maximum daily load portion, requires states to assess waters, to create a list, identify those waters which are impaired, to then develop TMDLs, or total maximum daily load studies, for waters that have been listed as impaired, and then to put together an action plan for improving those waters that have been listed. In January of 2002, the Office of the Legislative Auditor issued a report on this federal Clean Water Act requirement. and recommended that the PCA report to the 2003 legislature with a multi-year implementation plan on how we could move the TMDL program forward. And I think many of you probably saw that report. It was Minnesota's Impaired Waters, and this was kind of the recommendation that came out of that auditor's report. After reviewing that in 2003, the legislature adopted a rider on the budget bill which said, by February 1st of 2004, the commissioner shall report to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Committees of the House and Senate on the status of discussions with stakeholders on strategies to implement the Impaired Waters Program and any specific recommendations on funding options to address the needs documented in the agency's report to the legislature, Minnesota's Impaired Waters of March 2003. And legislative auditor report and the 2003 legislative recommendation resulted in the formation of the stakeholder group that we have referred to as the G16 and the development of the Clean Water Legacy Act. Now, why are impaired waters important and a priority for Minnesota? Minnesota has more surface water than any of the other 48 contiguous states. And water quality is a foundation of a $10 billion tourism industry and really a foundation of the way of life for many of us in Minnesota. To date, we have assessed a relatively small portion of the streams and lakes in Minnesota. We're required to do that assessment and then update our list of impaired waters every 2 years. The 2006 impaired waters list, which was approved by EPA, includes a little over 1,000 lakes and about 284 river and stream segments that are identified as impaired. This has a real potential for economic impact for the state. I think most of you are aware of the Court of Appeals decision related to the permit that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency issued to the cities of Annandale and Maple Lake for a new wastewater treatment facility. And that court decision essentially said that and prohibited our issuance of new wastewater treatment facility permits that discharge to impaired waters. And this has had a significant impact limiting development and economic growth in the state. If you look at this map, you can see kind of the significance of it. The impaired water of concern related to the Annandale-Maple Lake case was Lake Pepin, which is, let's see if I can use the pointer, I think Lake Pepin is, you know, way down here where the arrow is, and essentially the whole shaded area is the area that is impacted by this decision. Any facilities, new or expanding and existing expanding facilities in that shaded area, we are limited from issuing wastewater treatment permits except for in any case where they would have a reasonable potential to cause or contribute to a violation of the water quality standard. So we are very limited on what we can and cannot issue. Clean Water Legacy is really Minnesota's approach to meeting our Section 303D Federal Clean Water Act obligations, and this has been shaped over the last few years by the stakeholder effort and the legislative dialogue that occurred. The 2000 Clean Water Legacy Act policy bill, which was passed, articulates Minnesota's priorities and strategies for protecting and restoring our lakes, streams, and rivers. A real key of this approach has been the collaboration and cooperation among the state agencies as well as local units of government and non-governmental organizations in meeting these federal obligations and, most importantly, moving toward protection and restoration of our waters, ensuring the ability for economic growth. Clean Water Legacy, as I mentioned, has really been a focus on cooperation. all the agencies that have responsibility for water in the state have been working closely together to implement the act since it was passed last spring. The 2006 legislation really emphasizes efficiency, cooperation, and using existing programs and resources of all the agencies committed toward a single vision. There are really four kind of main components of the Legacy Act that we'll quickly provide you an update on the status of: the monitoring and assessment portion, the TMDL development process, the non-point restoration and protection efforts, and then the point source protection and efforts. The monitoring and assessment activities of lakes and rivers and streams provide the data that is then analyzed to determine if water quality standards are being met. Those waters that are not meeting water quality standards are then placed on the Section 303D impaired waters list. This list is developed the spring of even-numbered years and submitted to EPA for their review and approval. The Clean Water Legacy Act sets out a goal to have a comprehensive assessment of water based on a 10-year cycle. The funding in the act provides this first year of the plan, and then looking for increases in funding annually to get up to a full assessment to meet that 10-year cycle. PCA relies on monitoring not only from our organization, but other state agencies, other state and federal agencies, local organizations, citizen monitoring, and remote sensing for these assessment purposes. Included in the monitoring activities are lake monitoring. The PCA focuses on water chemistry, the DNR on the biota monitoring. Mercury and fish tissue is done by the DNR, PCA, Minnesota Department of Agriculture and Health working together. Water clarity, we rely greatly on citizens of the state through the Citizen Lake Monitoring Program and also on the University of Minnesota through remote sensing activities. Citizen monitoring has really been a key of the strategy for gathering our data. Currently, there are over 1,100 active citizen monitors in the state, 500 active stream monitoring folks. With those people, over 100 lakes are being monitored each year and over 700 stream sites. We're in the process right now of preparing. We do a every two-year report to the legislature on citizen monitoring activities, and that'll be completed very soon and available on our website. Stream monitoring, water chemistry is done by the PCA, the biology monitoring by the PCA, the DNR and USGS do much of the flow monitoring activity. Again, fish tissue by a group of the four agencies, and water clarity, the PCA in cooperation with many local organizations and agencies, and again, the University of Minnesota on remote sensing. The funding that was available through the first year of the program was $2.14 million for the monitoring and assessment piece. Of that, $1.86 million came to the Department of to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, $280,000 to the Department of Natural Resources for the activities that that we're carrying out. The next major piece of the Clean Water Legacy Act are the TMDL studies, or total maximum daily load studies themselves. TMDLs are established, again, for those waters that are not meeting their water quality standards. These reports are really critical to water quality and our ability to accommodate economic growth. TMDLs are very complex. They're scientifically rigorous reports that determine what actions are required to restore a lake or a stream segment. Generally, they take 3 to 4 years to complete. They include a study of the point and the non-point sources of pollution that are contributing to the problem. They also identify what the pollution sources are and then what level of reductions are necessary to reach water quality standards once again so that they can support the designated uses. The Federal Clean Water Act prohibits any new or expanding discharges to impaired waters if that discharge would cause or contribute to a violation of the water quality standards. And I think I've mentioned that before, and to date there have been approximately 100 different facilities that we've had to hold the permits on because we haven't had these in place. Once the TMDL study report is done and in place, then we can once again issue the permits as long as they're in compliance with the recommendations of the TMDL study. The specific TMDL developments, local governments and watershed organizations are very important partners in completing these. Of the 60 that we have going on right now, 53 of them we have local partners on that that are leading the projects with us. There are only about two that we're the lead on, and then several that we have contractors on. But by far, the majority of them are led by local partners. This is really critical that we have that local involvement early on because they do much of the implementation of making the improvements that are going to result in the water quality improvement that can result in the delisting of these waters from impairment. Even with the local partners, we stay actively engaged in the project, both by providing oversight, technical assistance, and training to those organizations. When these TMDLs are done, a couple of the key aspects are that when you do the calculations for the kind of load reductions that are necessary to achieve the improvement, we also look at potential growth, reserve capacity, so that that's figured in to make room for development to be able to occur. Once they're in place, pollutant trading between point sources becomes a possibility, and so that we can keep track of how much additional load could go in and still maintain water quality standards. The kind of the key equation that the TMDL study is based around is this one of TMDL equals waste load allocation plus load allocation plus margin of safety and reserve capacity. Essentially, the waste load allocation component are the point sources, what waste is coming in from industrial, municipal, and other direct treatment facilities. It also includes communities covered stormwater, covered by MS4 NPDES requirements. It includes livestock facilities that are required to have NPDES permits, and things like straight pipe septic systems. The LA, which is the load allocation, are those non-point contributions. Runoff from fields receiving manure application, for example. Runoff from feedlots that may not have adequate runoff controls. Urban stormwater. It may include wildlife. The margin of safety is really, it's a way to make sure that if there's any error in measurements, calculations, modeling, the assessments that are done, we build in a margin of safety so that we can have confidence that we can still achieve the end goals. And then the reserve capacity is that portion that is built in so that you have some room for economic growth and development into the future. The funding that went into this portion, the TMDL study portion, was $3.17 million. With that, we've been able to fund an additional 10 TMDL studies. We've listed them here. Again, they can be led by us or by a local governmental unit, which is our preference. We really like this approach of doing it through the partnerships because it builds that capacity for the implementation of whatever is determined in the study. I think it's obvious that doing the study doesn't answer all the problems out there. There's still some challenges that we face in implementing the solutions. Things like addressing straight pipe septic systems. We know that there are approximately 60,000 across the state of Minnesota. Reducing non-point source runoff can be a challenge. Urban and rural sources and the implementation costs that that go along with implementing these BMPs. Let me just give you two quick examples here of TMDLs. One is the Blue Earth River TMDL, which is focused on fecal coliform or bacteria impairments. This is in the Blue Earth River Basin of the Minnesota River. When we did this study, one of the things that we found in going in and doing the monitoring was that there are actually about 17 different segments where impairments were occurring. As we gathered the information, evaluated where the sources of the various bacteria were from, we were able to identify that this pie chart, which identifies that about 26% comes from surface-applied manure, about 71% came from incorporated manure sources, less than 0.5% from inadequately treated wastewater, and about 0.25% from adequately treated wastewater. And you might notice that the PET contribution is actually greater than the adequately treated wastewater portion and then the wildlife portion. Another example from an urban area is that of the Shingle Creek TMDL, which is a chloride impairment here in the metro area. And I think you can see the location there. The sources of the road salt in this watershed, about 45% came from the application that the cities were applying, about 27% from the application of from Hennepin County, about 14% from the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Private application was 8%. Storage facilities were about 5%, and residential about 1%. So once you identify what the sources are, then you can sit down and start talking about how do we get reductions and move toward reducing the sources and creating improvement. And with that, I will stop and turn it over to Doug, who will go through the next two portions.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Doug Thomas, Assistant Director with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. As Galen said, one of the challenges once we get done with the study part of a TMDL and that plan has been done, it's been approved, the challenge is really then implementing those non-point and point source projects to get those pollutants reduced that are causing the impairment and actually get that water off the impaired list and cleaned up. So I'm going to be covering the non-point source restoration and protection aspects of the Clean Water Legacy and then just touch on the point source restoration and protection activities. Basically, just kind of comment about non-point source in general. It's usually associated with those widespread diffuse activities such as agriculture, forestry, rural and urban development. And it's because those activities are largely unregulated under the Federal Clean Water Act, many of the strategies that we've adopted and are identified in the Clean Water Legacy Act rely heavily on our state's soil and water conservation districts, who in partnership with the U.S. Department of Ag are the ones who are primarily responsible with working directly with those private landowners that make up about 78% of the state to plan and implement those projects and practices that reduce non-point sources of pollution from those properties. We also rely heavily on our state's watershed districts. It's those entities with their unique blend of financing authorities and regulatory authorities that they're the primary vehicle when we look to the large-scale lake and river restoration projects that can be done around the state. And lastly, our counties, who are the primary land use authority in most of the state, as well as play a very important role in implementing and administering the delegated programs from the state of things like feedlots, individual sewage treatment systems, shoreland management, and wetlands. So it's really with those strong local government and private lands focus when we look at the non-point source activities that the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Minnesota Department of Ag have kind of come forward as the logical leads in implementing those non-point source pollution strategies that have been identified and are called out in the Act. Basically, this year, as directed by the Clean Water Legacy Act, our focus was really on restoration and protection, and we targeted that in 12 watersheds with state-approved implementation plans and kind of the geographic areas that shaded part of the state, which is where most of those existing 12 plans are completed and approved, and they're ready to go with implementation activities. On the protection side, we looked at a statewide focus, and we really looked at those projects where a local sponsor could show that the water resources that they want to implement activities to protect are identified and are associated in state-approved and locally adopted comprehensive local water management plans, taking advantage of that existing mechanism that we have out there where counties, watershed districts, and SWCs have actually gone through and done locally planning to identify priority resources and lay out projects and actions to start addressing those. So our efforts in 2007 were driven by a couple of things. One-time funding of $11.23 million from the Act, trying to accommodate that mix of both restoration and protection projects that I mentioned, capitalizing on existing programs in the proven delivery system. The Act really went a long ways to basically say, let's not create a lot of new bureaucracy. And so we took the tact of saying, let's look at those existing programs, those proven programs, and use those to really drive the implementation on our non-point source restoration and protection activities. And then lastly, to ensure coordination amongst the agencies. And the four main agencies that are involved in these activities include the Board of Water and Soil Resources, with our focus on project cost share and incentive grants, technical and engineering assistance, and reporting and evaluation back from those local governments. The Department of Ag with its Ag BMP program, and then conducting and continuing to look at research on the effectiveness of best management practices, making sure that we have the data to support the recommendations so that the right projects are being built in the right locations, making the greatest impact that we can. The Department of Natural Resources with their forest stewardship program and providing technical assistance, and then the Pollution Control Agency with the federal 319 grant, which was brought to the table in this process as well. And just a little bit about how it worked this year. We implemented this year's restoration and protection strategies first by working through the Board of Water and Soil Resources. We developed a shared implementation strategy between the agencies and our board with the representation from counties, soil and water districts, citizens, as well as watershed districts. We had a good forum to look at, well, what could a shared implementation strategy look like? From there, we went out and had a joint request for a proposal. We had a multi-agency evaluation of those. We had 181 requests for funding that totaled over $44 million. And remember, we had a just over $8 million available for those grant projects. 50 of those projects were for restoration, and 131 projects were protection activities across the state. We were able to fund 51 projects, and 67% of those funds went into restoration projects in those 12 TMDL project areas that have those approved plans. And just to wrap up, and I'm going to go very quickly through this because we actually have Kitty Tepley from Todd Soil and Water Conservation District here to talk to you about the Long Prairie River TMDL itself. But basically, just to point out, it was a proposal that targeted nutrient reduction projects in riparian areas, and we used the interagency process. It worked very well. We were able to allocate to them $420,000 for a two-year period of time, and bundling Ag BMP loan money, land and water treatment cost share dollars, technical assistance dollars, DNR forest stewardship, and just recently some additional 319 dollars, which are federal dollars that come through the PCA. I think this is the first time in my history working for the state, which is a little over 17 years, where we've had the ability to put together and to do this kind of an interagency project, which I think was a real success. And then lastly, a requirement that they will have to report those projects back to us so that we can track the location and the pollution reduction benefits and begin to provide an estimate of how much impact are we making, how much of the job are we getting done. I'd like to just wrap up with touching on the point source protection and restoration activities. Unlike non-point sources of pollution, point sources are largely regulated and permitted by the state of Minnesota. And the implementation strategy that we have is really focused on providing financial and technical assistance to municipalities to address wastewater, stormwater, and unsewered areas. Like non-point source, in this case, the Public Facilities Authority and the PCA are the primary agencies involved in implementing those point source restoration and protection strategy. This diagram just points out how the Public Facilities Authority is organized, and it's really the state's banker when it comes to loans and grants to municipalities for a number of these projects. To give you an idea of the things that were done last year, through the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, just a little over or a little less than $33 million was appropriated for low-interest loans to cities for wastewater and stormwater projects. Through their Wastewater Infrastructure Fund, $23 million, and that is in the form of grants and 0% loans for high-priority wastewater projects that are developed jointly between PFA and the PCA on a priority list that they work together on. New this last year is the TMDL grant program, where it provided 50% grants to municipalities for municipal infrastructure to address stormwater requirements and point sources. And then a phosphorus reduction grant program, which is a 75% grant to cities for phosphorus reduction, just a little over $2.3 million. And lastly, the small community wastewater treatment program, which again was new, which is a combination of being able to provide not only loans and grants, but also technical assistance to many of these small communities in areas where we have unsewered areas, and to try to find them a much more cost-effective alternative than establishing a traditional wastewater type of infrastructure in those areas. And with that, that ends our presentation. I'd like to again thank the chair for allowing us time today, and we're available to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. You know what, Senator Kubler, I was thinking we might wait till the end of the three to take questions.
Be fine.
Questions, too, if you don't mind. Ms. Fanmuller, you ready?
Thank you. Lee Fanmuller from the Department of Natural Resources. And just a real brief wrap-up comment. I think oftentimes when agencies come before these committees, it becomes a cliche to say that they're working together. But that really is the case in this under the Clean Water Initiative. And a couple of good examples of that is the DNR has actually hired one of the PCA staff to work with DNR to really help look at how we can best marshal our resources in the DNR to really support the clean water effort. And we really have a lot of expertise in fisheries and wildlife and ecology that we're really trying to apply to the monitoring and assessment work. And we think with our extensive field staff will really be important when we come to the implementation part. So we really, the group of folks here at the table, and I want to acknowledge Terry Coleman from PFA and Joe Martin, who's also here from Ag, have really been working very, very closely together for the last 12 months. And meet on a regular basis to make sure that we're not duplicating one another and that what we're doing is really augmenting and supporting each other as we move forward with this. So thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, let's go to questions. Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess to each of the witnesses, I'd be interested in knowing what each of your agencies received from the money allocated for the Clean Water Legacy and you know, how many requests you received for projects and, you know, how those matched up. I guess I'm looking for, you know, what's the difference between actual dollars that are available and dollars that are needed.
Go ahead, Mr. Thomas.
Pull together that information and get it to you as soon as we can.
Oh, hang on a second. Senator Kubler, I'm sorry. I was just talking for a second. Your question was, what's the... Can you repeat your question just because I want to make sure I wasn't going to ask it again?
Well, yes, I was just wondering, you know, how many dollars each of their agencies had received from the Clean Water Legacy dollars that were given last year. And maybe Senator Fredrickson could answer that, too. But then, you know, how many requests did they receive for projects? You know, what's the total value or dollar value of the project requests that they had received. And so you have some comparison between what's available and what's needed in the countryside.
Let's, why don't we ask our fiscal analyst, Dan Mueller, to help us.
Madam Chair, in your folder for today, I did create a one-page handout of the appropriations that we had in a couple of different bills last year that relate to clean water. So this will answer part of Senator Kubley's question about how much some of the agencies were given. The second part of his questions, I guess we'll have to hear back from the agencies about how much was requested for their for some of their projects. This table brings together the amount of money that was both in the bonding bill in the LCCMR bill last year and in the supplemental spending bill. You kind of there's pieces in each one of those bills that had projects related to clean water. It was a total of about $25 million in total money. $15 million of it was general fund. About $640,000 came from the LCCMR and about $9.3 million in the bonding bill.
Okay. All right, Senator Pariseau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would ask anybody at the table, at what stage are you in the actual assessment of the identified waters that you're planning to test and adapt TMDL? Because I remember we had some interesting statistics back in early fall, I believe, about how many waters have been tested generally and the results of assessment on lakes versus versus streams.
Madam Chair, Senator, there's two different systems that we use to monitor and assess. One is the 305B, which is a portion of the Clean Water Act. Another one is 303D. Using the 305B numbers, we've assessed about 10% of the streams in the state of Minnesota, and we've assessed about 16% of the lakes. The numbers are a little bit smaller when you look at the 303D list because it uses it's more restrictive in terms of what data we can use into it. It requires more specific and more data, and so the numbers aren't quite as high. Of those that we've assessed, though, it's about 40% have been found to be impaired, which is pretty typical with other states across the nation.
Madam Chair, I recall that those figures were kind of high, but there was some impairment in a lot of them, but they weren't all obviously the same. But are you expecting then that most of the others that you've identified will have an equivalent ratio or average?
Madam Chair, Senator, it's hard to speculate on whether we'll continue to see it. One theory would be that the ones that we've assessed, we may have assessed because of problems, and so maybe we've hit a higher portion of the early ones. It's hard to speculate. That's one of the aspects of the Clean Water Legacy was the emphasis on protection, that we want to protect those that are not yet impaired from becoming impaired, because it's probably cheaper to protect them from becoming impaired than to restore them once they get there.
Thank you.
On that 40%, though, what is the source of impairment for, how does that break down?
Madam Chair, that I don't have off the top of my head, but it can, unless somebody has it, it includes some of them are impaired for. A large proportion of them are for mercury. Of the 2,000 some that are impaired, about 1,200 are mercury. About 138 are PCBs. 106 are excess nutrients. 92 turbidity, bacteria or fecal coliform, 81 impaired biota or biology, 78 low oxygen, 35 ammonia, 15 and all others, 21.
Okay. That's not in our PowerPoint, is it, that we have in front of us? That's okay. I'd like to get a copy of that.
Madam Chair, the data we have is a little out of date, okay. But what's important is that the overwhelming majority of waters are listed for mercury.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know who to direct this to, and I apologize. I've not been on this committee before, and so I'm I would confess ignorance on many of these things that you all are probably much more familiar with, and so I hope if I'm asking stupid questions that you'll bear with me a little bit until I get to know. But in your PowerPoint, you talk about the number of impaired waters we have and the magnitude of the problem. And my question is, I've got two questions. First one is, what is the total cost to fix this problem? In other words, I assume we're going to be doing some appropriation and we're going to try to target some money, but if you're going to fix the whole problem as it's currently defined, what is that going to cost? If we were going to do it all in 1 year, assuming that was logistically possible, what would the cost be to fix that problem? Does anybody have a sense of that?
Oh, yeah. Madam Chair, Senator, I don't have it off the top of my head, but if we go back to the 2003 Minnesota Impaired Waters Report, we did take a stab at that, and I will say it was an estimate at the time, and let's see if I can find it. The estimate at that point in time was restoration activities would be close. Well, it's a large range, 46 to 230 million for the improvements necessary. TMDL studies about 8.9, and these were actually per year kind of estimates, and so you know it's a very broad estimate.
Senator Hand.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I guess I'm just trying to get a handle on what the size of the problem is versus the magnitude of what we're going to try to do to address it. And secondly, the second question I have has to do with the impairment that was being raised by Senator Parisot, and you've assessed certain number of certain percentage of the waters for impairment and determined to be impaired. Is the standard for impairment, I don't know what the right word is, but is it a good standard? In other words, if you say practically everything we breathe and eat and drink has got some kind of impairment in it. Is the standard zero impairment of any kind, or, I mean, are these impairments that are actually people are dying from or being harmed by, or just where does that impairment standard fit? And in your opinion, is it reasonable? I'm assuming that this is a standard that the federal government has given us, and so my question is it a reasonable standard? Is it really one that we ought to be focused on, or should we be asking the question about maybe the standard needs to be challenged? I don't know. I'm just asking.
Madam Chair, Senator, the EPA, a number of years ago when the Clean Water Act was created and following that, established some national level numbers. We in Minnesota have then evaluated and adopted Minnesota numbers, and my opinion would be that for the most part they are appropriate numbers. They aren't they look at if there are toxic effects. They look at does it have impacts to biology. The Clean Water Act, when it laid out its goals, identified that generally it's referred to as a fishable, swimmable goal, which means that you can have full body contact and that that you want the fish to be consumable as well as their living. So for each parameter, there is a specific standard that evaluates or was evaluated to determine what would be appropriate in terms of dissolved oxygen, sediment, what kind of effect that would have on larval fish and other things. So each one is based on a specific situation to that parameter and what kind of an impact it has on either biology or health effects. And then we have a set of designated uses for the various streams and lakes in the state, which defines what the potential uses should be, so you know which of the standards are applied and in that situation. So in my opinion, I think they are appropriate. They aren't excessively restrictive. I think over time, there are some standards that we may need to revisit and evaluate. Are there, because some of them have now been established for, you know, 10, 20 years, and so there may be new and additional information. So it isn't like we should never reevaluate them. But for the most part, I think we're confident and comfortable that they are appropriate.
Thank you.
So along those lines, if of those 60% of the lakes that have been found to not be impaired, would you be able to eat the fish from those lakes as often as you want without any limitation?
Madam Chair, there different lakes have been assessed for different things, and I think even some of those that have not yet been listed, for the most part, and Lee, correct me if I'm wrong, mercury, which is the fish consumption concern, has been found most places we've looked. And so I don't think in the case of mercury we would and fish consumption, which was your question, would I assume that just because we haven't assessed them yet, would we assume that you shouldn't be cautious?
Well, okay, but you said that among those that have been tested, 40% have been found to be impaired. So I'm assuming the other 60% have been found not to be impaired. Does that mean that they're only not impaired on whatever one particular compound you tested them for, or that they're clean in every way, you know?
Madam Chair, remember we've only assessed about 16%. Yeah. Of the 16%, 40% have been found to be impaired. Right. That doesn't mean, and then the other detail is that not in all of those did we do the fish tissue analysis to check for mercury. That may be a more limited set of data.
I would certainly, I mean, my gut would tell me that the mercury levels are pretty much going to be the same across the state, regardless of how pristine a lake may be. It still gets airborne deposition, which goes across the whole country, you know. But I don't know if that's one of the things I'm trying to figure out.
Madam Chair, the lakes we sample and the river stretches that we sample for mercury and fish are largely those that are the most heavily fished. So your assumption is correct. And even though we haven't sampled lakes, in general, we adhere to the Department of Health guidelines that even if a lake hasn't been sampled, there are standards that should be met in terms of how often you eat fish from the lake, whether or not we have sampled it. We use the same standards across the state.
I think Senator Kubley was next.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I don't have a question. My words are more of a comment, I guess, toward some of the things that Mr. Reitz was saying. It did seem to me, Mr. Reitz, that you were talking more along the lines before Senator Hahn asked his questions about things that would be classified as prevention rather than control. So, you know, there's a sense that, you know, the name of your agency carries with it the idea that pollution is a given and that you're simply there to control it. So I guess I would like to say that maybe you could suggest that if your comments on prevention become dominant at the agency, that maybe you ought to consider a name change from Pollution Control Agency to Pollution Prevention Agency.
Senator Kubley, I think since that wasn't a question, I'll just make an editorial comment. Commissioner Moore made what he believed to be an offhand comment about that the other day on the radio, and he was a little surprised that it was sort of a big news story, that he thinks the name should be changed. But I don't think he said what he thought it should be changed to. So, well, that remains to be seen. And he said he didn't have a plan to do that right now. But I think you make a good point. I think, you know, I have a lot of questions generally, but I think maybe there'll be, as we go through all the witnesses, maybe we can get some other perspectives on Senator Hahn's question, which is really, you know, how much would it cost to really test all of our lakes and streams and to do all these TMDLs that need to be done and to do the restoration and protection that needs to be done? And so I'm anxious to get more detailed answers to those questions, but we'll let some of the other folks help to fill in those blanks as well. If there's no other – did Senator Chaudhry, did you have a question for the group?
What was the reasoning behind not sampling fish in every lake? Mm.
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, it's financial. It's not cheap to sample mercury. We do both mercury and PCBs, and so we sample what our budget allows, and we focus it on those lakes where there's the most recreational activity, because we feel we're serving the public best if that's where the most recreational activity is.
Madam Chair,
Senator Chaudhry,
don't we want to get a true assessment of every piece of water that we assess?
Madam Chair, Senator, we'd love to, but we've got to make priorities with the dollars we have. We're also sampling for PCBs, and we've done some other select chemicals, and each tissue that you sample can be very expensive for some of those chemicals, but it's primarily mercury, and we also do PCBs, which is also the second highest reason why waters are impaired in Minnesota.
Senator Chaudhry, in the LCCMR, I think we asked the question about testing for endocrine disruptors, another emerging chemical contaminant that's scaring the heck out of me and a lot of people because it's being related by scientists to changes in fish that cause male fish to have female reproductive organs in them, which is not a fun thought, for species of any kind. and I believe you said you just haven't been able to test for those at all?
We haven't, Madam Chair, we haven't. We've done some cooperative studies with EPA that have looked at fish, particularly down below the pig's eye plant, but we haven't done anything systematic. And the other thing is we don't have a water quality standard for endocrine disruptors. Mm-hmm. We do for mercury and PCBs.
Okay. Test against.
Senator Chaudhry.
So then is it possible, for whatever reason, due to lack of resources or what have you, that a lake or a water that's been deemed not impaired could, in fact, be impaired, but for lack of testing?
Madam Chair, Senator, that's absolutely correct. And that's why we adhere to the same guidelines that we recommend for people who are eating fish from any lake or river stretch in Minnesota, just to cover ourselves, because there are waters that we haven't tested that, because mercury is so prevalent, it's likely that most of those waters do have mercury contamination.
So then, Madam Chair, are there other things that you have not been testing for other than mercury and fish?
Madam Chair,
of budget constraints?
Madam Chair and Senator, there's many things that we haven't tested for, to chemical contamination. And the question is, what's the most important and what's the highest priority? And the decision for many years in the state has been that mercury is really the top concern. So that's where we've put most of our overwhelming majority of our effort has been in mercury.
Give me an example, Madam Chair, of a piece of water that's not perhaps used very recreationally or fished a lot that would lead to your choice not to test fish.
Madam Chair, Senator, we often do it by size of lake in terms of we have information through our department as to the amount of, through CREO surveys, how much recreational pressure there are in lakes. So there are certainly, almost every lake does have some fishing, but it's the amount of pressure, and what we've done is put the priority based on our CREO surveys on where there's the most recreational use.
So, Madam Chair, what we're learning is that if it's deeming it not impaired, that's not necessarily true.
Madam Chair, that's correct. Yep.
So then why do we label it as such?
Because it hasn't been tested for that yet.
We're not labeling it as not impaired. What we're doing is we're labeling things as impaired. We're not labeling them as not impaired.
So that should be crystal clear.
Well, Senator Chaudhry, I didn't understand that until today myself, so either. And so I think that's something really important that we're learning. And I guess one other point I want to make that Representative Gene Wagenius keeps hammering in my head is that the whole clean water legacy issue and the TMDL process only deals with surface waters and not groundwater at all. So most Minnesotans get their drinking water from groundwater sources, and so we're going to have to spend some time looking into that issue as well about the state of our groundwater and whether it's impaired. But that's for another day. Senator Kubley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, just listening to how you collect data, there are some people who live in my district who feel that there is a greater concentration of mercury for lakes that are in the path of a prevailing wind from a coal-fired power plant. Do you have any evidence to support that assumption?
Madam Chair, Senator Kubley, that our sampling is based on that, or that?
Well, they're just, you know, my understanding is that their feeling is that they're, you know, if a surface water like a lake is in the path of a prevailing wind, that it would have a higher level of mercury if it were within a like a 3 mile radius of a coal fired plant. I don't know if there's anything to that. I'm just looking for information.
Madam Chair, Senator Kluby, I'm not aware that the data shows that. And what I actually, there's been another good cooperative study between PCA and DNR that shows there are areas of the state where we're actually seeing some decline in our fish. There are other areas that have been no change at all, but we have seen some decreases because of our new regulations. But I'm not aware of any particular pattern in the line of coal fire. Yeah, Galen is just mentioning to me where there are acid-prone lakes, then our acid lakes up in the northeast definitely do have higher mercury. That's the most prevalent character in the data.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony, all of you. Let's bring up the next panel. If you don't mind coming up together, are there four chairs up there? Just so we can keep staying. I think this is kind of an arbitrary grouping, so we don't expect you all to say the same thing. But these are, we want to hear from all different stakeholders on your opinion. And Ms. Zeller, we have you listed first if you'd like to start. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marie Zeller. I'm the Regional Director for Clean Water Action, and I break microphones. Okay, now I'm not going to touch it. I think the agencies did a tremendous presentation of a lot of the detail. I just want to say that as part of the G16, as an environmental organization that sometimes will say kind of pulls the left and holds the state to a very high standard for environmental quality, it's been a real pleasure to sit down with, you know, the Chamber, Farm Bureau, the cities, some very unlikely partners, frankly, and come up with a strong consensus around what needs to happen in the state of Minnesota around waters. And I think from, you know, our experience organizationally on the ground in communities, there's a great deal of concern that we're actually losing a little bit of who we are. When we see, you know, our water quality decline. There was the question that was posed about the standard of fishable and swimmable. People are often shocked to hear that that is the standard. It's like, wow, we're not protecting to a higher standard. It's just, you know, so we can touch the water and fish can live in it. And the fact that we have waters that aren't meeting those standards, that there are streams and lakes where people took, where your grandfather took you to fish, where you can't catch the same fish anymore, that there are swimming holes where you can't swim anymore, that, you know, there are, you know, rivers and lakes that parents, frankly, you know, are reluctant to let their children touch the water, that we have beach closings, you know, all the time along Lake Superior with human waste on the shores. We're losing a part of what makes us uniquely Minnesotan and something we're very proud of. And so it's heartening that the legislature has moved to establish this policy. I think we need to move with greater haste now to fill in some of these funding gaps, because the longer we wait, actually, the more expensive it becomes. The price tag seems big now. Well, it's going to get bigger if we don't start protecting and preventing and cleaning up some of the problems that we have out there. So that's, kind of my overarching comments. On assessment, the priority in getting the funds on the ground is critical in the short term, because we need to know what's clean and we need to know what's impaired so we can set these priorities and make some of these hard choices of, you know, where we're going to focus our study money and where we're going to focus our cleanup money. On the studies, we need it's not just a matter of complying with the Clean Water Act and getting the study done. It's also becomes a really valuable roadmap for communities, for counties, for watersheds to understand how we can develop our economies and grow our communities and still have this other part of us that's very important, which is good water quality, healthy fish populations and, you know, actually be able to touch the waters that are part of our communities. So it's a tool that's there not just for getting a water off of a nasty EPA list. It actually becomes a very valuable tool for mapping out how our communities can grow and prosper and still take care of the water. Finally, around looking at the cleanup and protection work that is out there, which is, you know, the lion's share of the funding that's needed, there was strong consensus amongst the G16 that no matter what the number was, and we think $100 million annually actually is fairly conservative, that at least 75% of that needs to go straight down onto the ground into these communities. It needs to go to farmers. It needs to go to soil and water conservation districts. It needs to go to upgrade septic systems and wastewater treatment. It needs to go locally. And we're not creating bureaucracy. We're actually directing most of this money where it's needed most to start, you know, cleaning up the water. And we also trust that people at the local level have got the best handle on how to do this. And frankly, if there's hard choices to make, we would like to see them made by the community at the local level through some discussion and consensus. So if it's a hard choice, you know, they own it. And so getting to that stage where we can have that money and make some of these cleanup choices as quickly as possible, you know, just gets us that much closer to, you know, taking some of these waters off the list and getting back to kind of a heritage that and a legacy, really. That's why it's called legacy, that we can pass on to the next generation.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mike Robertson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I would like to, as Marie did, emphasize the unity you see in the organizations represented at the table today. It's really unprecedented. We as organizations on this issue have been joined at the hip since for 3.5 years in promoting this, developing and promoting this legislation. And I'd like to speak a little bit about why the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is interested in this issue and feels it's so important. Number one, we are concerned about our environment. It's the place we live. It's the place we work. It's where we have our industries, and we all have to protect that land and water and air. Number two, it's an economic issue. As you heard earlier in the presentation by the state agencies, the federal law says that there can be no new or increased discharge into an impaired water until there's a TMDL developed and a plan developed to restore those waters. We are concerned about economic development. We're concerned about communities that are growing. We all know, and you heard during the session and presentations on these issues last year, heard about the Annandale Maple Plain case, where the cities are trying to develop a new wastewater treatment plant in a growing community. There was a challenge under the federal law, and we're awaiting the state Supreme Court decision about whether that facility can be built because of the provision of the federal law. We know that this problem has to be solved for environmental reasons and for economic development reasons. Annandale and Maple Lake are in the Lake Pepin watershed. Those waters are impaired by phosphorus. The Lake Pepin watershed, the body of water that forms a lake in the Mississippi River, is where all of the phosphorus from most of the state drains. 75% of the phosphorus, covering 55% of the land area of the state, drains into that watershed and is part of this total impairment. The work of the agencies right now in developing a TMDL for that watershed is very complex. It's costly. It's going to take a lot of time. It's not scheduled to be completed until 2009. But when you think of the magnitude of that, the amount of development that occurs in the metropolitan area and even beyond, it's mind-boggling to think about what is needed in order to make that water resource comply with federal law so that we can live and grow as a community. So we support the efforts that you will be looking at, Madam Chair, this year to provide funding. We as a group supported $80 million of funding, and we gave you a prescription that's still available on how to do that. We think we came back last year and said, how about $40 million in this short session? You gave them $25 million. It was a good start for them to see how they can spend the money. We are concerned about outcomes and that the agencies be able to spend the money adequately and effectively. And I think as you review that in coming weeks, you'll be seeing how they have done thus far. And we'll be looking at benchmarks on how we can see real improvements. But the bottom line is that large sums of money are going to be needed for our lifetimes in order to complete all of this effort. And so we are supporting, you know, a two-year funding in your current budget from the existing revenue, and we know that you're going to be working on where that money will come from over the long term as a permanent source. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Taxing.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities and would start off by echoing exactly what the two previous speakers have said about both the process and the uniqueness, and I think how the folks you see here have been in this legislative arena for a long time, and to see something where this kind of group with these diverse interests can not only come together with recommendations, but stay together with those recommendations as a group for 3.5 years involving many very difficult political battles says a lot about where we've all come to and the urgency of the decision. Minnesota's cities are very committed and very concerned about clean water. We're one of the primary permittees in the state. Every city that has wastewater treatment has a permit for having wastewater treatment, and has, you know, cities in the state have spent billions of dollars to minimize environmental impacts and improve environmental quality in their communities, both in wastewater, stormwater, and other non-point source projects. The impaired waters issue is one that has particular importance. As Mr. Robertson referred to the Annandale-Maple Lake ruling, that's just the that's the current case that we have in front of us. It was hypothetical until a couple of years ago. Now it's reality. We actually, in Minnesota, were found to be violating the Clean Water Act, and we're told you cannot issue any more permits if the permit being issued would cause a pollutant to be discharged into a water that we already know is polluted for that pollutant. So if you've got a water that we know has too much phosphorus in it, you can't issue any more permits for phosphorus going into that water until you have a federally approved plan for how you're going to clean that water up. And then, of course, that permit would have to fit within that plan, which is the tricky part. The question that was asked earlier regarded what is an impairment, it's pretty simple. Our waters each have a designated use. Most of our water in Minnesota, as was mentioned earlier, the designated use is a warm water fishery, which means you're supposed to be able to swim in it or eat the fish you catch in it. Fishable, swimmable. A water is impaired if it is not meeting that use. That's the definition of impairment. If a water is not meeting its designated use, it's impaired. And that can be for any number of pollutants. There's a long list of them, but we see phosphorus coming up over and over, other nutrient load types of issues. We see ammonia. We see fecal coliform, and we see temperature issues pretty frequently. Of course, the one that we see all over the state on a regular basis is mercury because it's, as the chair pointed out, an airborne issue that's we have limited ability for Minnesota to address on its own. The reason, though, that this becomes so important for cities is multifold. It includes the quality of life and the environmental and public health issues that having clean water bring to our communities, but it's also economic. It's our tourism. It's our ability to get a permit to grow as a community. For our cities, it even comes to whether growth will happen in the city or not. City needs permits to have these kinds of developments happen. If the growth happens in a more sprawling fashion outside of cities and is not done using wastewater treatment facilities, they don't need the same permit. They can go ahead. That's what we know is happening in the Annandale-Maple Lake area right now, is the cities there each had hundreds of new housing units lined up waiting for this new wastewater treatment plant to come online. The work was done. The developers were there. They were ready to go. And when that permit was turned down, those developers had to be told that they were not going to be allowed to build their houses because there was not adequate wastewater treatment for them. Well, you can guess the developers are still building houses. It's just not within city limits. They're building them somewhere else. They're putting them out in a new area, taking up some farmland, putting in a lot of septic tanks and bigger lots, and eventually we'll have the cost of the transportation and wastewater and stormwater problems that those will have down the road to deal with. It's a very complex issue, but it really does affect the economic ability of our cities to develop and grow. And as we move into this, cities had a number of specific issues that I know, in particular, the three of us came in with several things we knew we needed as regulated communities or communities hoping not to be too regulated. The process used to reach these conclusions. It really does not work in these instances where you find a pollution problem in a given body of water. It doesn't work to say, we know there's a phosphorus problem in this river, so we're going to address it the same way we've addressed phosphorus problems in every other river. The phosphorus may be coming from completely different sources. We've had rivers where one wastewater treatment plant was the cause of the problem. You fix the plant, the problem's gone. We've had others where none of the wastewater treatment plants were contributing at all to the problem. And, in fact, it was other things that needed to be done in the watershed to correct the problem. So having sound science done in each of these studies to make sure we're accurately finding what the load problem is coming from and who can best clean it up and fix it is essential to cities, to make sure we're not just wasting resources guessing on what will clean the water up. We also very much support the policies that were passed last year by the legislature to make sure that local involvement happens from the beginning, that the stakeholders, whether it's private property owners, local governments, businesses, various organizations from the communities, all sit down together with the state agencies right from the beginning and start talking about how are we going to study this in our community and what are we going to do as far as a decision-making process for how we're going to clean the water up. It's their water, it's their businesses, it's their lives, and it really is essential that they all sit down together to come up with that plan. The last comments I would make on the city perspective on this really come down to where the rubber meets the road on this is the funding. It's all great to talk about how we're going to have a plan for clean water. It's even great to say we're going to assess all the waters of the state and see what condition they're in. But that doesn't do anything to clean them up. It just tells us we have 40% of our waters polluted. And so the plan that we had put in front of the legislature and that we'll all be around talking to you about this session includes that $80 to $100 million need, most of which goes for work on the ground, as was mentioned, for wastewater and stormwater improvements to address those sorts of impacts on water, for money to generate additional resources from the federal farm bill, for non-point source projects with watershed districts and soil and water conservation districts. All of these things together are going to be necessary to clean up these various impairments as we find them around the state, and it is going to be a long-term project. I mean, it's going to take many years for us to get through this. I'd love to see us get significant progress in my lifetime. I'm very hopeful, but I really do expect it will be a good chunk of that before we would see us get to some place we can all proudly say it's a good thing we did that 30, 40 years ago. So, Madam Chair, with that, thank you for inviting us, and I'll be happy to stay around for questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Raddatz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris Raddatz. I'm the Director of Public Policy for Minnesota Farm Bureau. I did work on the G16 effort, and what impressed me about the whole process was that we didn't spend 3.5 years trying to blame somebody else. We spent most of our time realizing there's a problem out there, realizing we need to come up with solutions, and that is what we focused on. And I think at the table here you see probably three different interests from the standpoint of assessment, monitoring, the point source issues, and the non-point source issues. And I guess the one message I would like to leave you with today is that we need to fund the total package. We just can't focus on one particular piece of the issue or part of the problem. And with the realization over time, the need in one area may be greater one year, in the next year it may be greater in a different area. But we need to have this total package because, as Mr. Johnson said, it's great to assess everything, but that doesn't get us to improving the water or meeting water quality standards, and that's what we want to end up with. I'm pleased with where we're at. With the legislation just passing 6 months ago, as the agencies have talked, I think we're off to a positive start. We're looking at a science-based program. The interagency effort has been great, and it's resulted in no new bureaucracy. And that's kind of what we talked about as we developed what kind of financing need there was. It was what's within the capacity of the system to deliver on-the-ground product to non-point, to point source, or whatever. And so I think we've kept that in mind, that there is a certain capacity out there, and it's great if we can have more money, but if it's not used to the best use, then that's not the best use of those resources. And again, local stakeholder involvement. But I think it's clear in the last 6 months, too, that we've addressed the need for additional resources. I think I'd just make a few comments from the farm perspective and the non-point perspective. We identified early on that there's a real potential to leverage state dollars with the federal farm program dollars. When we first started this, we felt that for every dollar of state dollars, we could leverage up to $4 from federal farm programs through the various conservation programs, EQIP programs. And Madam Chair, at some point you may wish to have in the NRCS, FSA, some of those federal agencies where you could get into more detail on what programs are available. But the biggest need we identified from the farmer's perspective was additional education and then also technical assistance. Many of you are familiar with the Conservation Security Program, CSP. That pays farmers for the way they farm, basically. So if you're using more conservation tillage practices, moving in that direction, you actually get paid for using those practices. But like many federal farm programs, government programs, the application for that program is almost a half inch thick. And if farmers don't have the proper records, they can't successfully apply for those federal dollars. Last year, as an example, in Minnesota, there's a federal program called EQIP, which is an environmental quality program that, again, looks at conservation, feedlot upgrades, those kind of issues. NRCS had available $24 million, which was used in Minnesota by Minnesota farmers last year. That's a 50-50 cost share, so Minnesota farmers on their own contributed another $24 million, so that's $50 million. Now, that's not geared just to impaired waters. This also addresses the protection issue, too. So I'll just end with, again, the message that as you look at the funding needs, we hope that you look at the total package. That's what's needed to really address the problem. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I guess I don't know, Mr. Raddatz, if you said a dollar amount, but I think you're all in the same ballpark of $80 to $100 million a year. Everyone's nodding, more or
That's
less.
That's correct.
You said 100, Marie Zeller said at least 100. Okay. Expect you to be a little bit higher. Come on. Is the G16 still proposing a specific funding mechanism like we saw in past years, or are you just sort of whatever?
We learned our lesson on that one.
Okay. Good to know. Well, then we won't even go there. We won't even start talking about the past. We'll just move forward. Okay, I see some hands. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I applaud the work that you four and your organizations have done, and as with the preceding three. And I just I want to make a comment, and Madam Chair, you've heard me say this before. I'm most concerned when we're talking about pollution, both air and water, about a point of reference. That meaning, when were we at our worst in terms of water and air pollution, and you know, are we getting better, or are we do we continue to get worse, or whatever? I just think about my hometown, which is Grand Rapids, how 30 years ago the large, huge Blandin Paper Company was throwing everything in the river, in the Mississippi River, clay prep, mercury, shavings, plus the city was throwing everything in. Just up the river a couple of miles, the Clay Boswell plant, all its employees had to have a second car because the acid rain would come down and basically take the paint off the car. We're far past that, and with last year's legislation, in fact, Clay Boswell is going to have to invest a lot of money into reducing mercury. So I do not mean to minimize at all our problems with air and water, and we continue to support the work that's being done and hope we continue to do it and to fund it. But I just think it would be important, and would look forward to somebody sitting down with a bit of a historic point of view here, and just ask kind of where have we been and where are we going? And what are our goals in the, in the future?
You know, Senator Saxog, oh, I'm sorry, maybe you want to address that. Go ahead, Mr. Robertson.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Saxog, I think it's a very good point because the main emphasis originally in the federal environmental legislation and in our state programs has been to address point source pollution coming from municipal facilities and industrial facilities. And I think a major point to make here today is that we've made tremendous progress as a state in private sector and public sector in addressing that problem and meeting those discharge from the pipe standards. 30 and 40 years ago, we had those horrible problems that you described. And I think an indicator of that is the figure that the PCA has been using in looking at this impaired water situation. They have said that 14% of this problem, generally speaking, is from point sources, and 86% of this problem is from non-point sources. And when I use that figure, I'm not here to point a finger at agriculture or any other specific sector, because all of us in some sector or other are involved in that non-point problem, but it was naturally more easy as a federal and state and local government to address the end-of-pipe point source problem. We've done that. We're continuing to do that. But it's this vast, more complex problem of the non-point sources is what really this whole program is about.
Thank you.
No, but and I think those are very good points. And Senator Saxog, I think you raise a good issue that we need to, as a committee, we need to be educated about the big picture. And I don't want to, you know, step on Senator Chaudhry's toes and repeat everything he does in his committee as the policy chair. But I think it is important for us to make sure we, as and not all of us serve on his committee, you know, we understand where we're at with water and air in across our state. You know, how does it look? And I mean, this is a piece of it, and but we need the bigger picture too. Are things getting better or worse? And that would be helpful information. And I think, Mr. Robertson, you said the in your first remarks, you talked about outcomes, and I think that's also a critical piece of information. We need to make sure that we know where these dollars are going. Everyone is sort of agreeing that they're being well spent, but we need to know for sure how that is translating into cleaner water. And it sounds like there's not a lot of this money going towards more permanent state agency staff, I'm guessing, but we don't know that. I guess we want to hear sort of where all the money is going and how much we're getting for our dollars. A question we just want to continue to ask. Senator Saxon.
And Madam Chair, I think it's important, as you say, is that the policy committee is in charge of developing a lot of what you just said and what I just said. But the gentleman down there who actually came up with that last question is how are we going to raise this money? Mm-hmm. How are we going to raise $80 million? That's a great question for this committee.
Yeah, that's our big task to try to figure out. I'm not sure who was next. Senator Torres Ray?
Madam Chair, I have a question related to this with respect to the cost analysis of this investment in terms of how do we know that we're making a difference? Because it seems to me that we need to know if we are being efficient with our regulations. So if we are trying to stop pollution and just investing money in this, are we doing enough with regulations to make sure that, you know, that we're making a difference, because we're never going to be able to catch up. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but I'd like to know, as a new member of the committee, in terms of are we doing enough in terms of regulations so that we don't have to keep investing money and we're not making a difference?
I think that's a good question for the panel.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think an important element that actually has been built into this overall program is there's certainly the monitoring and assessment at the front end to understand and prioritize, but there's also the monitoring and assessment at the back end. So as we look at cleanup or restoration activities, there will be monitoring going on. If that restoration activity is not working, then, you know, we will have that data to show that, and then the local group of people that has worked on that TMDL and that is trying to restore that waterway they will take other action. So we have that built in so we don't continue to put money at something that's not correcting the problem.
But I think maybe, Senator, you were also asking, if I'm understanding you correctly, are there, you know, this is sort of a monetary solution to the problem, and it, rather than regulating, more regulation of non-point sources, which would gore some oxes more than others, obviously. But that may be a part of another approach to the problem.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct. I think what I'm alluding to is more our process to really make sure that we work on prevention more than anything else, because we are never going to stop this process if we are polluting the waters more than what we are preventing, you know, pollution. And I think that's, you know, we can talk about today in terms of, you know, funding, fully funding and putting $150 million. But if we don't have regulations for prevention, then later on we need 200 more, because we're not doing enough in terms of regulations and policies to prevent this. So that's more the kind of regulation that I'm talking about.
Mr.
Not
Raddick.
About this funding specifically, but in general, what do we do?
And Madam Chair, Senator, I would agree. I think it's important to understand that this is focusing, on the specific section of the Clean Water Act. And, you know, if it is the will of the legislature to go further and, you know, cast, you know, that broad, more broadly, then you should discuss that. Kind of the Impaired Waters Program is seeking to bring us into compliance with the specific chunk of the Clean Water Act. My organization couldn't agree more that we need to look beyond just cleaning up, and we have to be looking at prevention as well.
Mr. Raddick.
Yeah, briefly, Madam Chair and Senator, I think from the non-point source perspective, what Minnesota farmers historically have shown is a willingness to voluntarily change farming practices based on the best information. There's a whole lot more conservation tillage going on now than there was 10 years ago, and we're moving there over time. And the more research that we can have from both sides of the equation, number one, to show the farmer that it's going to work, it's going to make economic sense for their farm, and secondly, on the environment side, will these practices really result in a benefit? I think if we continue to move in that direction, we'll have a much quicker adoptance and acceptance of those practices. So the more, again, research that we can provide so that we know we're promoting practices that actually have a benefit to them is going to be important.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess just a comment for anybody or a question, which kind of similar to the one I asked the first group about the reasonableness of the federal policy. And it sounds like from the discussion and the example in the Annandale-Maple Lake decision, my conclusion seems to be here that we're saying is that virtually all the waters in the state are impaired. We can't put any more add anything to waters that are impaired, so that the conclusion would be we can do no more development until such time as this problem is completely resolved. And so my question is, since this is federal law, is this an unfunded mandate? And should we respond to this in some way similar to what we've done in other cases, notably in education, where we say, well, the federal government ought to come up with the money if they want us to not do any more development until we've fixed this problem, and it's going to cost us whatever hundreds of millions of dollars, and we need to have development right now, they better come up with the money to make sure we can accomplish that to meet their regulation. And just comment on that.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'll start toward the middle of your questions and say, yes, the Clean Water Act is an unfunded mandate. There's no doubt about it. There's very little money that comes even for the state agency to run their own water program. They're not completely funded for that by the feds. And so, of course, the infrastructure requirements that come out of this right now have very little funding. If it weren't for some of the changes the legislature made with one-time money last year, most of these new changes for wastewater and stormwater, for instance, for cities, would not be funded. We would be having the cities on their own, having to raise rates at their local level, not because their city was doing something wrong, but because there's a statewide problem of water being too polluted. They were following all the laws that they were expected to follow, following every permit that they had been issued by the state, and it's still not enough. So they're going to have to do more. However, that said, this isn't new. These requirements have been in place since 1972, we've been working toward them. As Mr. Robertson said earlier, we started working on point sources, wastewater treatment for industry and cities. We've added on to that since then, and we're now getting to this point where we're realizing that while we did significantly deal with some of those drastic crisis situations that we saw caused by point sources, we still have this problem that cumulatively everything we're doing has a bigger impact than the water can handle. And that's what, where this program comes in, and it comes a little bit to the Senator's earlier question about prevention versus this program. This isn't a program for the entire water program of the state of Minnesota. This really is because there is an identified area where we aren't meeting our obligation to have water clean enough for our public. And I don't think the standards where we're finding this to be a problem are very extreme. If they are, you can bet some of our groups are there saying this standard doesn't apply here, shouldn't apply here, this water has never been swimmable or fishable. There are processes for making those challenges. What we're talking about are the bulk of the cases where the science is there. There is a case to be made that this water is too polluted, and this is the process we've come up with for the best way to set that up. We do have a situation right now where we can't develop in a big chunk of the state. It's not that the entire state is impaired, but it's that Lake Pepin covers a big chunk of the state, and it is impaired. It's most of the state drains to it. So it seems really extreme right now because we have a couple of these very large drainage areas that are affected by it. I think what we'll see as we get into this program another 5 years or so is some of those big ones we will have a plan in place for. And you'll hear more about the kind that you have testimony coming on where it was a smaller local problem and they had to find local solutions to it. It's not something that stopped development throughout the entire western end of the state. It's something that they dealt with in one part of one county. So these are very, very different. Some are very small, some are very big. I hope that answered part of your question, Senator.
Madam Chair, Senator, also just to be clear, once the TMDL study is done, then that restriction, and we don't have to wait until the water is delisted or is kind of taken off the list because all the improvements are there. We just need to get the study in place so that we understand how we're going to deal with the problem. So as permits are issued, it's done within the study, the parameters for the total maximum daily load for the water body. So there is light at the end of the tunnel for the Lake Pepin watershed and it's the biggest one in the state, so all the others will be, you know, not quite as onerous to get completed, I would think.
Great. Well, I want to thank you all very much for your testimony. We want to make sure we hear from some of the people doing the local work. So let's bring up Kitty Tepley and Leanne Buck. We've been told the Senate is convening at 2:45. Is that what you said? Yeah, so which is our ending time of our committee, so we'll go to the end. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and respected members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Kitty Tepley. I'm the Water Management Coordinator for the Todd County Soil and Water Conservation District, and I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak to this issue.
Can I interrupt you for 1 second? Just
certainly.
Remind us where Todd County is, please.
Todd County is right in the middle of Minnesota. We are just north of St. Cloud. We're a little bit close to Alexandria. We're kind of close to Brainerd, right there. If you remember the map that they showed with the approved TMDL watersheds on it, we were the most northern of those watersheds. I'm here today to represent the very local perspective. The speakers before me have given you an excellent idea of how this was all done, what all of their agencies are doing for it, how it was organized, where it came from, and all those kinds of things. But I'd like to let you know how it's happening at the local level. As one of the previous speakers said, where the rubber hits the road, my boss is real fond of that statement. We actually monitor the resources. We're the ones out there in the hip boots and in the mud and in the mosquitoes. We're the ones that find the problems and work with the landowners and the cities and the industries to try to fix it. And with the Todd Conservation Office, we've been involved with the impaired water issues for a long, long time. This is not something that happens quickly. As it's been alluded to here already, nothing is going to happen overnight. In 1994, a citizens group that was concerned about the Long Prairie River came to the LCMR committee and received a grant to do a project on the river. They wanted to monitor and inventory and come up with a plan for the river. And the Todd Conservation Office partnered with them at that point, and we volunteered to do the actual water monitoring, collecting the samples, getting to the lab, finding out what they were. And about a year and a half after that, we were armed with massive amounts of data and didn't have a clue what to do with it. We attended an MPCA training session, and there I approached one of the speakers and said, okay, now what do we do? And they encouraged us to apply for a Clean Water Partnership grant to do the monitoring and assessment of the river to find out just exactly what was going on, and we did that. That was in 1996. We started monitoring, we collected a lot more data, and with their help, we've started figuring out exactly what was going on with the river. We needed to expand. We found out we couldn't just do it in Todd County. We had to do the entire watershed. And about 3 years later, we thought we had a pretty good handle on it. So then we applied for another Clean Water Partnership grant, only this one is an implementation grant, where you continue monitoring, but 50% of the grant actually went to the landowners to put practices in as far as cost share was concerned. And so we continued with that, felt we were doing a pretty good job with it, and applied for a continuation grant in 2003 that got unallocated briefly, but was restored in 2004, so we were able to continue our implementation. Along about the same time was when the TMDLs all came, and it was the big deal. And because we already had a lot of the data, a lot of the assessment, we were one of the very first of the small watersheds to actually complete a TMDL study. So, and that brought it really, and because we were able to focus on the problems and find out exactly where they were coming from and how to fix them, and it was entirely valuable. But there were a lot of bumps in the road. You know, we were one of the first ones, and so before that study could get approved, it had a lot of hoops it had to jump through. And so it has taken until this year, well, last year, 06, to actually get the TMDL implementation plan approved by EPA, and we are at that point right now. We're one of that very small group that actually has an approved EPA TMDL plan. But this is taken. We, like I said, this whole thing started way back in 1994. The cumulative dollar amounts here is getting close to $1 million, and we're just barely getting started. We have only scratched the surface of this whole thing. So when the Clean Water Legacy came along, we were joyous at the local level because we thought this is the tool that we need to actually get our job done. We have long-standing partnerships. We started out with the private citizens. We work with all of the cities in our county. We work with adjacent watersheds, with county offices, and with a multitude of state and federal agencies. And working together to protect, preserve, and restore our waters through all the local water planning, which I am. I'm a local water planner. It's done an excellent job of bringing us all together to work on these. But now with the Clean Water Legacy, is from my point of view, this opportunity to expand and improve on those relationships at the state and local level is just fantastic. Received some of this information on one of the earlier ones, but I want to review it again because the Todd SWCD and the Long Prairie River Watershed has an approved Clean Water Legacy grant, which we are very, very thankful for, and it's coming from four different agencies. We are getting low-interest loan dollars through the Department of Ag. We're getting forest stewardship dollars through the Department of Natural Resources. We're getting money from a couple of different pots from Bowser, Board of Water and Soil Resources, a small amount for technical and engineering assistance, and a larger amount, thank heavens, for actual putting the practices on the ground, the cost share, the development and installation of the conservation practices. And as of this last week, our grant was changed slightly, and now the other half of that is coming from MPCA $319 dollars. So we'll have four agencies to deal with. We'll have four work plans to write. We will have four reports to write for each one of these, and we don't mind a bit. Along with that, an awful lot, as our representative from Farm Bureau said, most of these practices will be piggybacked with federal dollars. Large practices now are so cost prohibitive that you have to find dollars everywhere you can to actually get them installed. Kind of going back a couple steps, when the Clean Water Legacy application to us to actually apply for the dollars came out, we didn't have a whole lot of time to do it, and we wanted to know exactly who was interested. So we did what we call a media blitz out in the rural areas, and you have to remember we have weekly newspapers and local radio. That's our media blitz. But we did, and we received $500,000 worth of requests in a week. We had landowners coming in with projects that were ready to go for $500,000. I was absolutely flabbergasted. I mean, this is one watershed in one county in a week's time with a, you know, fairly limited amount. I think most of it went by word of mouth. So we know the need is out there. The people are out there. They're ready. They're willing to do these kinds of things. And one of the things that kind of surprised me is who these people were. And it shouldn't have, because I'm one of them. I'm a baby boomer generation. And we are finding in Todd County that we are not so much an agricultural county anymore as a rural residence county. Those of my generation, a lot of us have moved to larger cities and metropolitan areas, and we've earned our livings and we've raised our families. But we are retiring back out to the country. We want our place on the river. We want our place on the lake. We want our 40 acres in the woods. And I'm one of them. I was raised on the Long Prairie River. I moved away, and now I'm back. My house is on the Long Prairie River again. So I'm definitely one of these people. And they are such a valuable resource. It's just unbelievable. Most of us have worked most of our lives, and we're ready to retire, but we're not ready to quit doing things. And I'm already finding in our lake associations, in our river associations and stewardship groups, that we have a magnificent bunch of people out there that are ready to go. They want to grab this by the tail and say, yes, we want this lake to be like it was when Grandpa brought us out here, and those kinds of things. Along with that, with the flexibility of Clean Water Legacy for the practices, we are all very familiar with agway systems and diversions and waterways, but this gave us an opportunity to do some other things. And we had people coming in for rotational grazing plans and fencing livestock away from our water and providing alternate watering sources, nutrient management plans, minimum tillage. And one of the ones that I am so excited about with our stormwater controller, rain gardens and low-impact development kinds of things along where they're building along our rivers and lakes. And people are interested in doing these things. Reforestation came in big time. Planting trees in riparian areas, and of course we had many bank stabilization and erosion control ones. And so these dollars will be going to those kinds of practices, because for your sake and ours, we need to show results. Most of these do not require 3 years of engineering and, you know, plans this high. These are things that we can actually accomplish in the next 2 years. We can get these done. We can come back to you at the end of this and say, this is what these dollars have actually done. I'm kind of biased. I've been working in a soil and water conservation office since 1975. But conservation districts have credibility with the landowners. They're used to coming to us for these kind of erosion and pollution control practices. And judging by the, excuse me, the response that we got from this applications from offices like mine, I don't think most of us would have any problem with helping you to administer an ongoing problem for the Clean Water Legacy. Soil and water districts, watershed districts, water management coordinators like myself, every single county has us. We already have the staff, we have the office, we have the computer, we have the vehicles. But probably most important, we already have the partnerships developed that it's going to take to make this successful. The majority of us already have cost share programs in place that we're administering. When we were approved for clean water partnership dollars, we took the standard state cost share form and put Clean Water Partnership on the top. Yesterday, I took that same form and put Clean Water Legacy. The only difference is the state cost, Bowser cost share are white. The Clean Clean Water Partnership ones are blue, and now the Clean Water Legacy ones are gray. So it's the same contract with the landowners. They're not having to deal with anything they're not familiar with. How easy was that to do? If this becomes an ongoing program, one of the things I don't feel that you will have to deal with at all is to create a mechanism to deliver it to your constituents, because it's already out there and we're ready to go. In closing, I'd just like to say, in the state of Minnesota, and that includes all of us, we have a responsibility to take care of our waters. And along with what we've heard, the EPA is telling us we have to. But with the Clean Water Legacy, with stable funding, I think this can be the tool that we really need to do the job.
Thank you very much, Ms. Tepley. Are there questions?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak on the Clean Water Legacy. I'll be brief. I am the Executive Director for the Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and I'm also maybe referred to maybe in my job description as 1/16th of the G16. So it just shows again today that the variety of people that came together to look at this. And one of the things as we focus in, soil and water districts have an expertise in the non-point arena, and that is what we're trying to accelerate with the Clean Water Legacy. And according to the numbers, again, and I'll just reiterate that Doug had said, according to the Board of Water and Soil Resources, approximately $8 million out of the $20 million last year was available to local government for a one-time appropriation for the non-point arena, or the not-from-the-pipe type of pollution problems. Just within a couple of months this past fall, Bowser received over $44 million in requests for those nonprofit from local soil and water conservation districts, as well as other government, local government entities. And so I just want to extend to you a thank you. And as one soil and water district commented to me, they are grateful for the initial allocation, and to be effective, they will need to have a continued and stable funding for the Clean Water Legacy to reach their goals to help delist and address those non-point problems in their watershed. So they are working one-on-one with the landowners, and again, we will continue to do that, and we work on a voluntary. So we're a piece of this, and again, I guess the thing to applaud the agencies, I love people like Kitty with the excitement that she has from the local level. And what was nice during this last go-around with the grant application process, because Bowser, PCA, Department of Ag, and DNR all partnered together, soil and water districts didn't have to apply to four different agencies. They had one application process because the agencies at the state level were coordinating. That was a lot. The savings to taxpayers, because you didn't have local government spending a ton of taxpayer time trying to get those dollars. So again, as we learn and we'll continue, soil and water districts are learning as they go through this. We're just like you in some respects, trying to learn and understand the EPA guidelines. But we're doing our best at the local level to meet those. So again, I want to say thank you for your commitment that you've shown and the support for the Clean Water Legacy in the past. And as we go forward too, we're like the other G16s. We want a solid commitment, and we're looking again at the same price tag, probably 80 to 100 million. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee?
Well, Madam
Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, how much money did we put? $25 million? Is that what we put
in?
Yeah,
one time last year.
And how much do we need?
Madam Chair and Senator Vickerman, of that $25 million, you must think about it too, that only $15 million was general fund. So some of this, the programs we're talking about, you might want to think in the back of your minds, might be bondable too. But whether we can always keep a piece of the bonding bill for these sort of projects is something that will have to be talked about or not, or whether we strictly pay for it always out of general fund. So there's some options within that we certainly will have to discuss.
Well, Madam Chair, I just bring this up because there's only a limited amount of money. I'm on a budget division this year. And I need money to help in the ag industry. I've already got a $75 million bill in for veterans. So how do we fund all that? Let me tell you two things. Ag and veterans are going to get a big piece of this budget. I'll do what else you want, but you're not going to walk away from farmers that I represent in my district, and not going to walk away from veterans who have died and got arms and legs blowed off. I'm going to take care of them. So we'll have to figure out how all this system works. But it's nice to talk about this, and I'm all for it. But let's be sure that we don't just put everything. This takes $100 million, I was told, really, if you want to get something done. That $75 million has got to come someplace. I don't trust the federal government, to tell you the truth. I really don't. I wouldn't want to bank on anything that they're going to tell you, because I watched what they did in the veterans issue. Supposed to take care of the veterans, they whacked $6 million right off. Mm-hmm. So don't count 100% on the... And what, hope we got what you got. Let's lock it in. I guess I'm getting older and more senile, but I'm off what takes place.
Senator Shadid.
I'm willing to work with you, Senator Anderson. I told you that.
I know. We're
going to
try to help each other here. Senator Shadid, did you have your hand up?
Yeah. Mr. Mueller, can you explain what part of the process can take bonds?
Madam Chair and Senator Shadid, they're probably a lot of the, especially dealing with the wastewater problems and, you know, putting out new grants for wastewater treatment plants, the TMDL grants received bonding dollars last year, and maybe some of the other speakers can also add to this, but stream bank protection, buying lands that some of the work the DNR does with streams and lakeshore and things like that, some of that might be bondable if you're actually buying the lands or restoring some of the land. So there are a number of things that could be bondable, but the testing and ongoing, at least initial testing and ongoing things, probably are not bondable.
I think we're going to have, I just told Mr. Johnson, I want to bring Allison Wolf up here. She's the last one who hasn't had a chance to testify, so we want to get her testimony in. We're going to spend a lot more time delving into that, Senator Shadid. So it's a really important question, and we're going to have bills in front of us, and once we get the agency budget, we'll get a better answer to that question. So I just want to finish our agenda for today. Welcome, Ms.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Allison Wolf from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I'm here partly on behalf also of Minnesota Environmental Partnership, which represents 80 environmental groups, 80-plus environmental groups, who support $100 million per year in combined cash and bonding funds, as you were just discussing, for Clean Water Legacy. I wanted to get into just a tiny bit of history. MCA has been fighting to protect our natural heritage for 32 years, and even at 32, as one of the older environmental groups, we still aren't as old as the Clean Water Act that we're talking about today. And we were also present at the creation of the G16, which grew out of conversations among our staff and I think Mike Robertson and some of the other folks that talked today. And the concern was just that we were falling behind. This was in around 2000, and just that was kind of the beginning of the process that resulted in the stakeholder group known as the G16, a few 16ths of whom you just heard from earlier. And recognizing that federal mandate existed, the group tried to figure out a solution. And as you know, various different things have been proposed over the years, resulting in last year's appropriation of $25 million. The number of $100 million a year can cause a little sticker shock. And I guess just to put it in perspective, I was comparing it to the cost of fixing up the crosstown, which I think is estimated at $300 million, and that's just a piece of the city that I live in. But I think that when we're talking about our huge gift of shoreland and shoreline and waters in Minnesota, we really are obligated to be stewards of that wonderful resource. And I kind of think of it as our natural infrastructure that goes along with the built infrastructure. We're very accustomed to spending large sums on the built infrastructure, the highways and the public buildings. And I think this is an example of our natural infrastructure that really needs our attention. There's a deferred maintenance issue you've been hearing about today. And I think that the numbers sound really spectacular, and the cost is large. But when you think that we have more shoreline than any other state other than Alaska, I think that's the reason for the high cost. I was just going back to the 2003 report that the PCA did to the legislature, which was mentioned earlier, and looking at the number that was estimated then to clean up the non-point sources on the 2002 list. And the estimate at that time was $600 million to $3 billion for the total cost of cleaning up. And that so that was the estimate in 2003. So I think we just have to kind of keep this number in perspective and realize it's a long-term investment that we need to make. And if we want our children to have the same opportunities to enjoy all of the outdoors that we've grown up in and enjoyed, we need to make this investment in cleaning up and protecting our water. The Clean Water Legacy Program needs at least $100 million a year, in our view, from the state revenues to do that job. So I'll just end there and take any questions that folks have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wolf. I think that's a good way to end. You've really, I think you make the case very, very well, and it is a different way to look at it. This infrastructure is priceless, to use a little bit of a cliche, but it is. Any other comments or questions from the committee? Great. Thank you so much.
And, thank you.
This was a really good start to a really important discussion. We're going to spend a lot more time on members. And we'll be meeting our normal committee schedule next week, Tuesday and Thursday, and agenda to be announced. But we're going to start with overviews. And we're supposed to go up to the session.
And Madam Chair, we just adjourned the session till Tuesday at 11 a.m.
Okay.
And we did receive the tax bill from the House.
Good job. All right. With that, the committee's adjourned.
No, we don't have a session.
Yeah, I guess so. That's fine.